The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today it is Thursday, June the 7th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. We can do it together. Just visit norml.org to get involved today. Joining us on the Audio Stash today is one of the foremost figures in the marijuana law reform movement, Dr. Lester Grinspoon of Harvard University. Grinspoon is Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at Harvard and author of numerous books on marijuana. He's offered expert testimony in front of Congress, numerous state legislatures and courtrooms, as well as to filmmakers and the media. Grinspoon's relationship with Normal stretches back to the foundation of the organization in the early 1970s when the Schaefer Commission was meeting. It's a great privilege to have him here on the program as a guest. We'll have part one of our interview with Dr. Grinspoon today and part two tomorrow. Dr. Lester Grinspoon, welcome here to the Audio Stash today.
My pleasure.
It's wonderful to speak with you. Doctor, you've authored some of the earliest modern books regarding marijuana. Tell us how you first got involved with researching and writing about marijuana.
Well, it's a strange story. Right after my residency in psychiatry at Harvard, became a young faculty member. And my first research project was one on schizophrenia, a very large seven-year study of schizophrenia. And we were writing it up as a book. That is, I was the senior author, and I had two other authors. The deadline for manuscripts, before we arrived at that, I was told by one of the fellow authors that it would be a two-month delay in his getting his manuscripts in before I could put the book together. So suddenly I had a block of time that I had not expected. And I was very concerned about this dangerous drug, marijuana. This was in 1967, and I felt, well, I'm going to go over to the Harvard Medical Library, and immerse myself in this literature and try and put together a reasonably objective paper on the science of the thing and see if I could get it published in a vehicle which would reach a lot of young people. And maybe that would help those young people who just couldn't believe or didn't pay any attention to what the U.S. government was saying about it, or organizations like Partnership for Drug-Free America and so forth. What happened was that I discovered that I had been brainwashed, like just about every other citizen in the United States, that marijuana was far less harmful than either alcohol or tobacco, and that the harmfulness from it came not so much from any inherent psychopharmacological property of the drug, but from the way we as a society were treating it, namely arresting at that time about 300,000 to 350,000 people a year. Now, of course, it's up to 800,000. This paper was originally published as an 80-page paper in the International Journal of Psychiatry, now defunct. But I was unable to get a smaller version of it published in a popular journal when the editor of Scientific American called me and said, I'd like to have a shorter version of that for Scientific American. And indeed, he put it right at the top of the list. It was published in 69, I think it was. And it attracted an awful lot of attention. My wife and I were listening to 11 o'clock news when we heard a Harvard professor says marijuana not very harmful and urges legalization on the news. And with that, to make a long story short, I was approached by a couple of presses and finally decided to go with Harvard University Press and, you know, write a book. I figured I'd become so interested in the subject that, and this is the first book I had ever undertaken. And so that's how Marijuana Reconsidered was conceived. And I worked on that book for long and hard. And I became convinced that not only was it a remarkably non-toxic substance, but there are lots of things about it that I personally was interested in. And frankly, would have started to experiment personally with it at that time. It was published in 1971, received a front page Sunday review in the Times under the title The Best Dope on Pot So Far. It made a splash. But I decided for that reason I shouldn't start smoking, because I anticipated, correctly as it turns out, that I might be testifying before various committees and courts and so forth, and the question would inevitably be asked, Doctor, do you smoke marijuana? And I wanted to be able to say that I had never smoked it. But that resolve collapsed about a year and a half after the book was published, and I have been using it ever since, which means that I've been using it over a third of a century now.
Doctor, your work is really focused on two things, schizophrenia and then marijuana. We see those two things in many current research articles sort of coming together. How have those topics evolved, do you think, since your work first began?
Well, I think that, you know, as the government's case for the toxicity of marijuana has collapsed, all of the things which I looked at in researching Marijuana Reconsidered, you know, that it led to violence and rape and loss of brain, all of these awful myths that had been propagated by the United States government have fallen apart. And so I think now there somehow is a way in which looking into this becomes subverted, and so you get papers that say try to prove that people who are young will become who use marijuana will become depressed later in life. that's so silly, or that it causes schizophrenia. Now that is, you know, there are effects on, there are reasons why schizophrenic people perhaps should not use cannabis, but on the other hand, you could look at an article published in the Journal Psychotherapy, I think it was, that that collect the data that recidivism, as far as rehospitalization is concerned, schizophrenic patients is reduced by schizophrenia. It's hard to say anything about whether those people should use it or not use it. But I think it's very clear that these people who are pushing the notion that it causes schizophrenia are way off the beam, because schizophrenia is a brain disease, the foundation of which is laid down long before adolescence, but which comes to manifest itself usually in adolescence or late adolescence. But that kind of thing, you know, it's what was a major motivator for the Indian Hemp Drug Commission in 1894. So many of the people who were admitted to asylums, mental asylums in India, were said to be suffering from cannabis psychosis. And in fact, the Indian Hemp Commission found that this was just nonsense. And we keep repeating this. This is the most difficult area. You can no longer get away with saying that it will destroy your brain or your cognitive function, or it causes such a lowering of testosterone that it can even be used as a male a way of making a male incapable as a prevention of pregnancy prevention. This was all taken quite seriously, but these things have all been—they're easy enough to discard. Like the two Harvard psychiatrists who had the world believing that young adolescent males who use marijuana will develop breasts. I mean, these things are easy to refute, and they've all been thoroughly refuted. But when it comes to more subtle things like schizophrenia and depression and so forth, those are tough, and they're the ones that keep every few years there's a new approach to the dangers of marijuana, and it almost always is in the realm of brain or mental disorder area.
And as someone who's seen the mythology and the media spin on marijuana in our modern age of prohibition, the prohibitionist scare tactics have changed very little. They attack on this visceral level with lies about psychoses or male production and then false notions of addiction. Is it these visceral scare tactics and lies alone that have kept marijuana illegal?
Well, first of all, I want to be clear that I am opposed to children and adolescents using cannabis. Not because I would cite the data data in quotes that this person would cite, but because there just isn't enough, we just don't know enough about it to be absolutely certain. As certain as I am in adults that it's not going to be very toxic for any adult to use cannabis, certainly not as toxic as things like alcohol or tobacco or lots of the prescribed drugs that are abused. It's hard to say where you can find some toxicity, but I can't feel that certain about children or adolescents. And I think until we can really be sure about that, I don't want to scare them, but I would say, look, you know, just as you have to wait to get your license to drive to a certain to be able to drive, you really should wait until these developmental processes are all more or less complete before, if you're determined to use a drug like marijuana, simply because we just don't know, and why take a chance? So it's not that I'm in any way in favor of adolescent or children using this, except, of course, my own son used it, but he had cancer, and it was very helpful to him. But I I think in general that is a great way to try and frighten people. The trouble is they've cried wolf so many times it doesn't even work as something that is frightening.
We're with Dr. Lester Grinspoon here today on the Audio Stash. We have links to his website, marijuanauses.com, on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Dr. Grinspoon, you have testified numerous times on behalf of marijuana and legalization. If you would, tell us about some of the public forums that stand out most for you.
You probably don't remember Gabriel Nahas or his book. He was my chief antagonist in the 70s and 80s. He was a professor at Columbia. And when he got up, we were both at the Kennedy Committee, he got up there and started to rail about me. I told Senator Kennedy and the other committee members that the story about how he had threatened to sue the New England Journal of Medicine and me over a book review that I did for the New England Journal on his book, Keep Off the Grass, threatened to sue me for $1 million, which in those days was a lot of money. Incidentally, the New England Journal of Medicine caved into him and published a new review, which was just as horrendous, as just as critical as mine was of his book. And they also promised not to give me a chance to respond to it and to publish a letter from a colleague of his that would be critical of me. That was certainly a dramatic time when I brought up. But I think the most dramatic time before a committee was before a state. In fact, it was the Massachusetts a Senate committee, and I can't remember which committee it was. But by this time, I had testified before many federal and state committees, and sure enough, a senator in whom it was clear that he was hostile to my position, said, and this was about a year and a half after Marijuana Reconsidered had been published, he said, "Doctor, have you ever used marijuana?" And I said to him, "Senator, I'll be glad to answer that question, but would you tell me first whether, if I answer affirmatively, it will make me a more or less credible witness in your eyes?" Well, he stood up and said at me, "You, sir, are being impertinent." And he walked right out of the hearing room. When I got home that night, I said to Betsy, "Look, the time has come. The waiting is over. Let's try it." And, you know, so many of my friends had used it. Carl Sagan, who was a very close friend of mine, was you know, suggested that I was, now that I had satisfied myself that it wasn't very harmful, why wasn't I using it and so forth. And we'd go to these parties in Cambridge, and people would say, would always offer us marijuana, and we would decline. In fact, a couple of times people had said to me, "What, you wrote a whole book about marijuana and you don't use it?" And I said to them, "I've written a whole book about schizophrenia and I don't have much experience with that." But at any rate, that was the first time that we used it. And in fact, I had an unusual experience there, because both of us said, "What's all the fuss? This doesn't affect us at all. There's nothing to it." And I became rather anxious, because I thought, my goodness, I've written a book about a placebo. And on the way home, Betsy reminded me that I had pointed out in the book that most people don't get very far the first time, that in fact, mentioning Carl Sagan, it wasn't until his sixth attempt that he actually got high. But nothing seemed to matter. I was so anxious I couldn't sleep last night. I thought I'd demonstrated something fraudulent here. And it wasn't till later that I realized, much later, that I realized that I'd had a kind of psychoactive effect, but it was an anxiety effect. I was very anxious that night about the possibility that I had done something which would be seen as fraudulent. At any rate, subsequent experiences were not the second, but the third one. I knew that I had become high because while my boys were always telling me to get my head out of the Baroque and listen to the Beatles and Grateful Dead and so forth, I never was very interested in this music, although it was always on the what was called the hi-fi at home. And until this night, again, it happened to be in Cambridge when the third time we were offered it, and I heard Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band for the first time in all the times I had actually physically heard it. It really came through, and that was the first clue that I had finally gotten there.
And if you don't mind, let me ask how you use cannabis today. Do you use a vaporizer?
I was one of the first people to use a Volcano, and people have sent me, I have a whole shelf, a long shelf of various vaporizers that people have sent me because, you know, they'd like to know my view of it. I use the Volcano whenever I can, and I think it's... in fact, the inventor of it came to visit me here in Wellesley and taught me some of the fine points of using it. But no, I think it's a wonderful invention.
Now,
You know, I told him, I said, you know, what concerns me about this is the price. There are lots of patients who can't afford this.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's got to come up with a, and you know, is this I said, I'm sure this is going to be very successful, and I hope that when it's produced in large numbers, as I'm sure it will be, that you will be able to lower the price so it's accessible to people who need it as medicine. The price hasn't come down.
Definitely regarded as the Cadillac, if not the Ferrari of vaporizers, for sure. Dr. Grinspoon, let me ask also, you brought an interesting website online, marijuanausis.com. We have links to it again today at normalaudiostash.com. And on the site, you publish first-person essays from individuals about their use of marijuana. So, you know, what made you decide to bring online this type of open forum and ask the public to send in essays about how they use marijuana?
It has, I think it's very important that people, if they can afford to, or will pay the price of being open about their use of cannabis. And for lots of people, there is a severe price, and I don't, I understand that. For example, again, when Carl Sagan wrote Mr. X for me, we agreed. We, you know, there was no question. We even lied about his age to be sure nobody was on the right trail because it would have really, you know, here he's a witness before NASA committees and so forth and so on. But my own view was that I was going to be open about it. In fact, on a Barbara Walters show with Norman Zinberg and Robert DuPont, myself, she asked the question, this was, I think, in about 1974, have any of you ever used marijuana? And Norman said no, and for heaven's sakes, I've smoked with Norman many times by then. And DuPont, who I've never smoked with, but I knew he had smoked, said no. But I decided to say, I'd always been open about it then, and I was open it on a national show. And that's partly because I think that even then I understood that until people got over the stereotype that the pot smoker was some kind of a loser and couldn't do anything useful in society until they understood there were people who were quite serious about their work and life and so forth and so on who use cannabis. They were never going to overcome this government-sponsored barrage of propaganda. So, and then the second thing is that, you know, at first I thought that marijuana was just for recreation. When at the time I wrote Marijuana Reconsidered, but during that time I came to understand its use as a medicine for thousands of years, but particularly its use in Western medicine. And by the time I organized that website, I knew that in addition to recreation and medicine, there was another usefulness of cannabis, and that was as what I have called the enhancement use. That is to say, the cannabis is not just for fun and not just for medicine, but it can enhance a lot of experiences that human creatures have. And I don't mean just, appetite, or what it does to food. It can turn an ordinary meal into a culinary treat or sex or what. I think those things are all sort of there. I mean people who learn to make use of it for creative purposes, for writing or painting or just philosophical purposes or seeing of helping them or helping them to see the natural world and so forth. This I call enhancement. And so the purpose of the site was to help people see this side of it, that there was something else beyond fun and medicine that contributed mightily to. And these are people who have experience that and are willing to share it. Some of them use their names, others want to do it anonymously for very good reasons, but the fact that so many will use their names is I think important to our ultimate goals of freeing this remarkable substance from this terrible prohibition and all is derived from that prohibition.
We're with Dr. Lester Grinspoon, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at Harvard University and author of numerous books on marijuana. His website is marijuanausis.com. We have links to it at normalaudiostash.com. We'll have part two of our interview with Dr. Grinspoon in tomorrow's Audio Stash.
Hello, this is Webb Hubble. Life insurance is now available for responsible marijuana smokers. For years, responsible marijuana smokers have not been able to access affordable life insurance products. They've been forced to lie on applications, forego the health benefits of responsible marijuana use, or purchase life insurance products that did not require an application or a physical. If they were honest about their use of marijuana, they were either flat out declined are rated so high that they could not afford the coverage they needed. No longer. Recently, one of Normal's members contacted them with a problem. He was expanding his business, and his bank was requiring additional life insurance. His local insurance agent had told him he simply had to quit smoking marijuana to get the coverage the bank was requiring. He didn't want to quit, and he wanted Normal's help. They contacted me, their insurance agent, and someone who is familiar with the insurance problems marijuana smokers face, and we both wanted to find a solution. I contacted my associate, Marvin Address, a nationwide expert in the area of life insurance, and we took on the challenge. Marvin was finally able to convince a carrier to underwrite the Normal member without the usual negative implications of marijuana use. The member not only received the coverage he needed, he was able to save additional money on the premiums he was paying for the coverage he already had in place. Normal uniquely supports cannabis consumers. As a result of this occurrence, Normal, Marvin, and myself decided that the time was ripe to make traditional insurance products available to responsible smokers without the usual negative implication. Two carriers have already agreed to offer all of their traditional life insurance products at all levels without excluding individuals who smoke marijuana responsibly. I am hopeful that this program can be ultimately expanded to make available disability and health insurance products as well. Help Normal and help yourself. If you've been declined for life insurance, are paying above market premiums, or simply want to know what now may be available in the way of insurance for marijuana smokers, contact me at info@mclaughlinonline.com or simply call me at 202-293-5566. Challenging as it may be, Normal is a public interest organization working hard to both reform cannabis laws as well as providing valuable services to their membership and cannabis consumers all around the world.
To Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.